It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our family is happy to be part of this statistic. More than 45 million households in America are home to at least one cat. That's according to research from the University of Arizona. We explore the language of cats and how they have learned to communicate their needs and their wants through millennia. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Brown is a cat behavior scientist. Her new book is called The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, you say there are millions of feral cats in the world who live almost entirely without humans around them. How does our interaction, our human interaction, affect the behavior of cats?
Well, yes, there are millions of ferals, and the whole thing about cats being so amazing is that they can adapt to so many different environments. So they can live completely independent of people, as feral cats do in groups, in colonies. They can live, solitary lives as ferals, and then all the way through to, the cats we have in our homes, living, pampered, wonderful domestic lives with us. So, the interaction between people and cats is very profoundly different in different situations. So there's not a very quick answer to that question, but pick any one of those places and their relationship with people will be different.
You say how domestic cats, they originate from shy, solitary wild cats in North America, and these cats joined humans after they learned to talk to us. Why would ancient cats want to communicate with people?
Yes, so the relationship is thought to have begun back in North Africa about 10,000 years ago. And these were wild cats that would hang around the very early human communities that developed back then. When people started to change from hunter-gathering to growing crops, then settlements developed and little farming communities developed. And the wild cats would hang around these settlements because we stored grain, and these stores of grain began to attract rodents. And these rodents were what attracted the wild cats that were looking for food. And so they would hang around, and the farmers gradually realized that these wild cats were very useful as pest controllers, and so would have tolerated them. And over time, wild cats got used to being around people and being around each other, and gradually learned to communicate with one another and with people. And it's thought that this is the way that they gradually found their way into our homes. They crept over our doorsteps and sort of self-domesticated themselves.
So the cats kind of found job opportunities as rodent hunters.
Exactly. Yes, they were good at it. And they did it, they filled a niche when they were needed.
So dogs versus cats, we know that there is some strong feelings on both sides of that. The American Pet Products Association says cats are the second most popular pet in the country. Dogs are the most popular. How do cats and dogs communicate differently with people?
That's an interesting question. I think part of that relates to how more domesticated dogs probably are than cats. So We dogs have been around us for a lot longer than cats, and also dogs are descended from a social species. They come from wolves that were already social, and they had a whole repertoire of social signals to use already made, whereas cats come from a solitary ancestor, and so had a lot more work to do, if you like, to try and develop new signals that we would understand. So wild cats, for example, would communicate by scent, and that works great over long distance when you're not socializing up close, but it obviously doesn't work terribly well with humans. And so cats have had to learn new signals, tail signals, they rub around us, they meow at us, whereas dogs have much more obvious signals, I think, much more familiar signals to us. So, they use eye contact a lot more, and they're much more eager to please probably than cats. So they work very hard at communicating with us.
Sarah Brown is a cat behavior scientist, author of the new book, The Hidden Language of Cats. You can join in with your questions and comments about cat behavior, cat communication. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You say cats owned as pets largely lack the typical qualities of domesticated animals, like selective breeding control and viewing people as their, quote, leader. How really domesticated are cats then? Sarah, can you hear us? I think we're having a connection issue here with Sarah Brown. Sarah, just wondering if our connection has failed with us across the pond. I think we're having some problem here. Sarah Brown, scientist of cat behavior, new book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. You can be part of this discussion about the lives of our feline companions. 800-642-1234. Sarah, can you hear us now?
I can. Sorry about that. If that was me.
That's okay. You know, how much control are cats in? I mean, how domesticated are they? Because you've talked about how they kind of, you know, selective breeding control, viewing people as their leader, maybe not so.
Yeah. So in some ways, I mean, they've changed a lot from behaviorally from their wildcat ancestor, in terms of their behavior, but physically they look a lot like their ancestors. So if you saw a wildcat, an African wildcat in your garden, it wouldn't look a whole lot different to the, you know, to a domestic cat in your garden. But behaviorally they've changed a lot, and that's where they've worked really hard, and that's where why I wrote this book, because I wanted to illustrate how hard they have worked at creating new ways of speaking to us. But other than that, the main reason they're not terribly domesticated is that they don't necessarily work well under controlled breeding circumstances. So people do breed cats, but most cats, the majority of cats in the world, just breed amongst themselves quite freely, you know, and not under the control of people. And that's why we have, you know, so many feral cats that grow up, you know, without any contact with people, because cats are so good at adapting to any place, and they will just breed, you know, amongst themselves without, they don't need us to breed. So yeah, that's the element of domestication that they lack, really.
You saw that independence firsthand, you know, when you looked at feral cats, you observed them in their environment, you know, many years ago. What did you take away from those observations going there every day? And I think it was the grounds of a hospital.
Yeah, so I studied two groups of feral cats, and one lived in the grounds of a big old hospital, like you say, and the other was a group that we rescued from the grounds of a school, and they were then neutered and relocated on a farm. And I watched these two colonies for a long time, and I used to go every day and watch them with my binoculars the old-fashioned way, and record everything they did, basically, to communicate with one another. And, you know, after all this time, I then analysed all the behaviours that I'd seen them do. And one of the most interesting behaviours they did use was the tail-up signal, which is when the cat walks up to another one and raises its tail into a vertical position. And I discovered that this, when one cat approached another with its tail up like this, it was very unlikely that any hostile behaviour would follow. So it was a sort of greeting behaviour, I come in peace sign, and and it would be followed by rubbing or other friendly behaviours. Whereas if it approached with its tail down, you know, very much more mixed bag of behaviors could follow. So, you know, they might be a bit aggressive or just less friendly. So this tail up signal was a really big, important part of cat society.
Oh, and that tail up etiquette, our cat does that to greet us. And there's even a little quiver.
Right.
There's a quiver in that tail up. What is Maddie saying to us?
I love the quiver. The quiver is like, oh, I'm really pleased to see you. And, you know, as you say, they use this same behavior to greet us, just as they would greet another cat. And yeah, the little trembling at the top is it just excitement, really?
Aww, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Sarah Brown with the scientist of cat behavior. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. A new book about our feline friends presents scientific evidence about how impressively cats have learned how to communicate both with each other and with us humans. Cat behaviorist Sarah Brown's book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen in Madison. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi there. Hi, I have a cat that I adopted when I was 7. And in her previous life, she had lived with a Chihuahua who was her best friend. And she has had adopted a lot of vocal patterns that seemed canine to me and play patterns. And I just discovered recently that she likes to be chased. And I'm just wondering how else I can, you know, learn to understand my cat.
Yes. Karen, thank you. Sarah, what has the cat picked up from the Chihuahua?
Yeah, that's really interesting because there's been studies, you know, on cats and dogs living together, and the two species have, you know, quite different signals in some circumstances. For example, you know, a tail swishing behavior in a cat is a sign that it's not very happy, whereas obviously tail wagging in dogs is a happy signal. And, you know, similarly, cats like to greet each other, you know, nose to nose, and dogs like to go the other end when they greet each other for a sniff. And so, you know, you see in houses that dogs, my own dog has done this. He's learnt finally to greet my own cat with his, you know, nose to nose rather than the other end. And they've studied animals to show that they can, these two species can learn each other's signals quite well. In fact, a lot better than we do a lot of the time. So it's, you know, it's amazing to hear these stories when a cat and a dog pick up, you know, traits from other species within their household, particularly the sounds. I'm very interested in what sounds the cat makes that a dog like. That would be really interesting to hear.
Karen, what are those sounds?
She actually kind of barks a meow. It's more like meow, meow.
I wonder if the Chihuahua used to bark back. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, it's lovely. Just encourage her to express herself and, you know, talk to your cat as much as you can is what I'd say, because I think developing that communication with your cat is great, whether it's dog talk or human talk or whatever.
Karen, thank you so much for contributing. Jessica now in Eau Claire. Jessica, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I work for a local animal shelter, and we do not have the ability to do trap, neuter, release, and we get a lot of barn cats in. And I was just wondering, how old does a cat, like, or how young to domesticate them, essentially? Like, is there an age where, like, it's hopeless and we're not going to be able to make them into house cats?
Yes, so that's a very good question. And you know, early studies showed that sadly, the socialization period for a kitten is really early on in life. So the period between 2 and 7 weeks old is that time when they need to get handled by people and meet people and, you know, just generally be around people in order to grow up to be comfortable and friendly towards people later in life. So 2 to 7 weeks is when it kind of has to start. So it doesn't have to, you know, it doesn't have to all happen within that. So say, you know, you've got a feral kitten that you pick up at around 7 weeks, you know, that's not too late to start the process. And that's just a general sort of rule. There's always exceptions. So I've met feral kittens of 11, 12 weeks that are sort of, you know, just on the edge of, well, is it too late to socialize them? And, you know, they can be brought round. It's often a lot harder and a lot longer of a process to try and socialize them. But generally speaking, 2 to 7 weeks is the period in which they need to have some sort of exposure to people in order to, you know, to turn them into a sort of socialized cat.
What if they're no longer kittens?
Yeah, that's tricky. And and as the caller will probably confirm, it's difficult. You know, the people do spend a lot of time, you know, one-to-one on feral cats and try and bring them round. And sometimes it's possible to make them more friendly. Even the cats that I studied, the ferals that I studied outdoors, they never became, you know, or to say sort of friendly or very tame to me, but they would get nearer and nearer to me as time went on and sit closer to me and tolerate me. So that's often the best you can do with the feral. And in those cases, it's best to find them a home, you know, not inside a human home, but a farm home or a barn home or somewhere where they have more freedom.
I picked up that when choosing a kitten, you called it something of a lottery in the kitten's temperament and their personality. Why is that?
Yeah, it's very hard to tell because kittens are cute, right? All kittens are cute.
Absolutely, yes.
And you might get the odd one that doesn't look quite so friendly, but generally speaking, most of them, you know, in a domestic litter situation, we'll all look quite cute and friendly. So it's hard to tell exactly how they're going to turn out later in life. But there are ways that, I mean, obviously, what I just said, that whether you can find out how much it's been handled in that 2 to 7 week period is the most important thing for how friendly it will be later in life. So finding out, you know, what it's experienced in the first 2 months of its life is very important.
What if the mother cat has had a lot of that socialization, has been part of a family? Does any of that translate over to the kittens, that trust?
Yes, it does. And that's what I was going to say. So obviously the parents put in some genetic input into the kids' personality. And the mother's is often very much reflected in how she behaves around people. So, you know, if she's a friendly mother, then she will encourage her kittens to interact with people. But also the father, if you know the personality of the father, that's a really interesting thing about the father is that kittens inherit how bold they're going to be from their father, and studies have shown that like a bold male cat will produce bold kittens, whereas a shy male cat will produce shy kittens. And those kittens can still be socialized and brought around and made more friendly if they get that socialization, you know, when I say between 2 and 7 weeks. But yeah, the parents do have a big input, but so does their environment. You know, how much attention and, you know, how many household things they're exposed to as they're growing up as kittens.
Sarah Brown, author of the new book called The Hidden Language of Cats. Your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Sarah, how does indoor life affect a cat's health when they only stay indoors?
Well, behaviorally, obviously indoor life is very different to an outdoor life for a cat. Mm-hmm. And that's fine as long as they get plenty of enrichment indoors. So you're trying to replace, you know, stimulation that they would have had outdoors. You need to try and replace that somehow indoors. So enrichment means things like scratching posts, places to climb, places to hide, lots of things to play with, lots of toys, puzzle feeders, things like that. Anything that makes life a bit more interesting and a bit more of a challenge. So, you know, not just just a general bowl of food, but, you know, scatter feeding their food or, you know, like I say, puzzle feeders, places to go up high. They like to, you know, that you can sort of extend their range of places to visit by giving them places to hide, you know, on top of the wardrobe or shelves or cardboard boxes, all sorts of things, and just as much enrichment as you can find to change their daily life and their daily routine.
They also
and play with your cat.
Yeah, when you're talking about climbing, I mean, they'll certainly climb the upholstery and the couch in places you don't want them. You know, what is the scratching about?
Yeah, so scratching is one scratching is a fascinating behavior because it's so important for cats to scratch, and it has so many different functions. And the one that we always think of is the more obvious one of keeping their claws healthy by, you know, removing the outer husks of their claws. And that's when they scratch on our couch and we think, well, you know, it's so annoying. But actually, it's scratching is a very important social signal for cats, because they have these scent glands between their toes called the interdigital scent glands. And so when they scratch, they leave scent marks on the surface that they're scratching.
And
this is a really important social signal. And also those scratch marks are actually a really important visual signal for cats. They actually see the scratch marks, which we hate.
And we're going to pause right there with Sarah Brown, Studies Cats. You can call in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown, whose new book explores the domesticated cat's journey of ups and downs into our Wisconsin homes. And you can be part of the conversation. Email what's on your mind about feline companions, ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jay in Madison. Jay, hi. What is your question? Hi, Jay. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Hi. Yes, go ahead. Yes.
I have a 4-year-old silver tabby who I adopted from a shelter, and he must have been food deprived somewhere along the line because he's insatiable, always wanting food and calling loudly for it. I've been giving in to him too often, I feel, because he's put on a little too much weight now. And he also is somewhat aggressive to our other cat, who we've had for now 8 years. And so I'd like to know how to do two things. Get him satisfied with the amount of food that we'd prefer to ration, so he doesn't put on too much weight, and then the aggressiveness that he tends to show.
Thank you, Jay. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a very complicated question. I think one of the first things I'd say is that, you know, maybe just to get him checked out by a vet, if that hasn't already happened, just to check the weight situation and the hunger situation, that there isn't some kind of medical problem going on, that he is so hungry all the time. And assuming that that's all okay, there's obviously some element of competition going on between the cats for food. So I would always say, even if there isn't competition, that you should feed cats separately, so that they're not fed in the same place at the same, maybe at the same time, but not in the same place, so that your other cat doesn't feel sort of terrorized or frightened to eat or having to eat very fast in order to get his ration or her ration. With your cat that's very hungry all the time, one idea is to try and not provide the food all in one go. So, you know, for a meal, separate the cat from the other cat and do some scatter feeding or hide the food. You know, if it's dry food particularly, you can do all sorts of games with puzzle feeders and make it work a little bit more for its food. And that's a way of the cat getting some exercise while also moderating, you know, the amount and quantity of the food at the same time as entertaining them a bit and taking the focus off quantity and, you know, constant food. Make it more of a game is what I would suggest, but maybe get it checked out too, just to make sure there's not a medical issue, is what I'd say.
How much stress can be introduced when you do have two cats in the home? What might that feel like for the cats?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it varies so much. So the cat, you know, is innately a solitary species. It comes from a solitary ancestor. And that said, domestication has equipped them with the ability to live alongside other cats very well when necessary. But some cats are better at this than others. So it's best to think very carefully about, you know, having two cats and how you introduce them if you're going to have two cats. If you know that process should be done very slowly and carefully, but once you have got two cats in a home together, it's very important that they have enough resources. By resources, I mean litter boxes, food, places to sleep, enough of these resources to live separately if they need to, if that makes any sense, so that they have different areas of the house where they have something that they need. So they, you know, a litter box each and hopefully an extra one somewhere else in the house, so they don't have to compete for the litter box. Because sometimes competition is very subtle between cats. So one might be very subtly bullying another one and you would never know. They might just sit near the litter box when the other one needs it, or you know, sit near a cat door, or all sorts of strange things go on that are probably not very obvious to, you know, to the casual observer. And so just providing enough space or resources is very important, so that they can separate their lives and live, you know, timeshare a house if they need to.
I thought it was so interesting how you said adopting cats even from the, or kittens from the same litter, in the end, they may not get along. You just assume cats, kittens from the same litter would get along.
Yeah, very much so. And I actually have two cats that did exactly that. They were the best of friends. And, you know, how could they ever not love each other, you thought, when they were, you know, sitting in your lap together. But as time went on, and as time does go on, sometimes they don't see eye to eye, just like with people sometimes. And, you know, and that's a situation where just providing enough resources, you know, enough beds so that they can clear off and go, and one can sleep in one bed and one can sleep in another, it is very important, so they can, you know, they can both happily exist but not necessarily be in the same social group as what we say when they, you know, so like if they, sometimes you see cats that are very bonded and they curl up together, and we would describe them as very much in the same social group, and they love each other very much. But, you know, sadly it doesn't always happen, but they do learn to tolerate one another quite well if you provide enough things for them.
Sarah Brown, author of the new book called The Hidden Language of Cats. Let's go to Missy in La Crosse. Missy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I had about 6 months ago, there was a cat that started to appear at nighttime on my Ring doorbell. And I've just been noticing that it's been out late at night and doesn't have a collar. And I've never had a cat. I don't know much about cats. And I just wondered, you know, I've started to become a little concerned about, like, oh, it's getting cold out. And is there something as a homeowner I should be doing to, you know, aid in the cat, or help it, or just leave it alone? Do you guys have any thoughts about, I guess, number one, are cats able to survive out in winter in Wisconsin and be okay? Or do you have any tips on what homeowners can do if they find a cat around their house? Because it seems very friendly and it seems like it wants to come in, and I don't know what to do.
Have you fed it at all, Missy? Have you given it food?
No, we haven't.
Okay, Sarah, go ahead.
So yes, this is another very interesting one, and often, you know, a very common occurrence, sadly, because, you know, it's hard to tell when a cat turns up on your doorstep. So is this cat, you know, a stray? Is it hungry, or is it actually just like my cat, what we call a six dinner Sid, who wanders around the neighborhood getting lunch and dinner at every house it can and then returning home quite contentedly? But it sounds like if it's happening in the middle of the night, that perhaps the cat, you know, it might be a stray. You don't say whether it looks thin or whether it looks a bit bedraggled. That's often a good way of telling whether it's, you know, it's cared for, you know, whether it's really actually an owned cat. It's you could possibly put posters up around the neighborhood saying, you know, is this cat yours? One thing we do in the UK sometimes for cats like this, outdoor cats, is if you can touch it, if it lets you touch it, you can put a little paper collar around it saying, is this your cat? Please, you know, call me on this number if it is. And then that way, you know, if it then goes back to its owner and the owner can see it's visiting other people, the owner can make it evident to those people that it's their cat and they don't need to be adopted. Because the danger is, as you've sort of indicated, that if you start to feed the cat, that the cat will then come more and more. And that can sometimes be okay, but sometimes it's not okay if, you know, if the cat's on a special diet or, you know, for whatever reason. Yes, or Yeah, I would go for the posters or the collar, or just ask the neighbors. Have you asked around next door and, opposite and up and down the street whether anybody knows whose cat this is? If it becomes a long-term problem, you could catch the cat, take it to a vet, and the vet will scan the cat for a microchip to see if it's got a see if it's registered with anyone, because most cats these days have a chip when they're owned, and that's a good way of tracing the owner.
Can you talk about the scent of with how cats smell, and because it's such a major part of a cat's life, why is smell so important for cats?
Yeah, it's hugely important, partly because they started off solitary and that was their go-to way of communicating. So they would leave scent marks for other cats to smell later. And then that way they didn't have to ever, encounter one another and have awkward encounters face to face. And they have such an impressive sense of smell. They have two methods of smelling. They have, their noses just like us, but they have this extra organ of smell in the roof of their mouth, called a vomeronasal organ, or VNO, which they also use to smell these social smells that other cats and other animals will leave. And so, yeah, they spend a lot of time smelling things and leaving scents that we can't smell, or that we don't try and smell, that we don't know about. Like when they rub on us, that's scent marking, or when they rub on an object, you might see if the cat in your home rubs on the edge of a doorway, they'll leave a little dark smudgy mark eventually, which is sort of waxy secretion from their from the glands around their mouth. And like I said before, a scratching, even that leaves a scent mark. So everything around them is scent based.
Let's go to Edward in Maguanago. Edward, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to bring up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a feral cat. Well, he was feral. He's about 5 years old. Found him on our farm, and we've since moved. But he was very friendly from the get-go, so I think he had been around people earlier. Long story short, we domesticated him. I had him neutered, and we have a total of six cats. And so a lot of them are young, his age. He's very playful with most of them. But my girlfriend moved in with her cat, who is a female and about 4 years old, and she's also spayed. And they were okay in the beginning, but he started to target her, and it got to the point where he would seek her out and was so aggressive when he would attack her. Like, we would have to physically separate him, we'd get cut up. And so now we've been at this point for almost 2 years now, where one of the cats is in our bedroom during the day, and then we switch them out, in the afternoon. And that's the only way that they can coexist, because they see each other. She growls and then, starts the startle response and runs, and he chases her. And it's very scary because he's such a friendly cat, but when he sees her, his demeanor completely changed. We've tried pheromone collars, direct supervision, playing with them in the same area. They used to eat in the same place and, supervised, but the thing we haven't tried is medication. So I'm just wondering, like, any thoughts on all of that?
Wow, Edward, thank you for sharing. Sarah.
That's such a shame. Do you have any idea? Was there a sudden event that changed their relationship? Because it sounds like they got on okay at the start, and then something pushed that a little bit.
No, it was just a slow and gradual, like, and I think it grew because he would chase her and she would run. And she's
Yeah.
playful with the other cats, but I think it just became a predatory prey.
So you think they
And she's
both get
terrified.
along with all the other cats? They both get along with the other
Pardon?
cats. It's not. Do they both get along with the other cats in your house, or is it
Yeah,
split?
and Camilla, her cat is kind of less social, but she's come around with some of the younger cats that she plays. The only other cat that Bob, the male that we're referring to, doesn't seem to get along with as much as my very old, like 17-year-old male cat. He will target
Right.
him as well, but it's Thomas is old and he like doesn't run. He stands up to Bob, so it's a little different dynamic. Whereas Camilla will run.
Yeah, he sounds like quite a dominant cat. Does he go out at all? Do guys go outside, or are they indoor cats?
No, they're indoor. He would prefer to go outside, and he used to. He'll get out if he can, but we've limited that and stopped that for the most part.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think in the absence of any, it sounds like you've tried most of the methods that we try. You presumably you've tried gradually introducing each other's scent to them slowly, having separated them. Have you tried that? So you put one cat away from the other for a while so they don't have any contact, and then swap their scents over so something that smells of one cat goes in with the other, and then gradually increase this exposure of scent to each other, and then because scent is the first thing that they get used to with each other, and then supervised introductions. But you mentioned that already, so I assume that you've probably tried these methods. You could get a behaviorist in to actually go through your case bit by bit. It's very hard to do long distance when you can't see the whole setup at home. Yeah. But I just think you're gonna have to keep them separate for some long period of time until you can gradually try and introduce them to each other again slowly.
Kind of starting from scratch again, as if
starting from scratch. Yeah, yeah, literally. Is the way that we do. We go back to they've never met is how I would describe that process that we normally do. But it's very hard when you've got a lot of cats in the same situation.
Edward, thank you so much for calling in. Sarah Brown studies cat behavior. New book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. You can join in. Questions, share, comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown, our guide to the origins of today's domestic cats and their remarkable ability to adapt and live in almost any environment. Call in with a question, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. We have Nancy in Prairie du Sac. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. I have a story to share. We have a nice feral cat. She's about 4 years old now. We live in the country, and early one spring, actually it was in 2019, I found a mother cat who was a feral cat lying alongside our shed. And then 2 weeks or so passed, and I saw this kitten skirting around the garden. And I thought maybe she was around 4 weeks old just by what size she was. And I noticed her climbing up this tree near our horse shelter. And I started to offer her food and then play with bale twines, things like that. And then finally, I was able to touch her. And I took her to Madison to have her spayed. And we kept her in a cage for 5 days. And about the same time, we had a puppy. And the kitten and the puppy became really good friends. And this puppy was taught by the kitten how to hunt mice and bunnies. My husband named the cat Hunter. Good idea, because that is what she is. So one day I saw her stalking a pine squirrel. You know how fast they are. Sometimes I find live bunnies running around my shed. She has to climb up a 5-foot chain link fence to get in and out of the shed, the barn, because we don't have a cat door, per se. And so that's what she does. And then she sleeps with our dog in his doghouse. And I might mention, we always had, because the dog and she are so close together, I have always given her monthly flea and tick ointment. And then she gets wormed twice a year. So this feral cat is awesome, and I would be lost without her.
Oh, Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Sarah,
that's
what stands
story.
Out to you?
Yeah, that's a lovely story, and she sounds like the perfect example of a cat that's got a, still kept her wild side from her mum, and still keeps her wild roots, but still likes some of the home comforts of a home and a companion in the home, like the dog. That's lovely. I love that. It's a blend of different lives of cats.
I want to bring up our sweet cat, Maddie, who lost her ability to meow. She was diagnosed with tonsillitis earlier this year by the vet. How does losing the ability to communicate vocally affect a cat's behavior?
Is this your cat?
This is my cat, Maddie. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
No more meows in her life. Yes.
Well, I'd love to know how you have found that. Has it changed how you interact with her because she can't meow at you and get your attention? Does she use other methods to get your attention now?
Yeah, eye contact is huge.
Eye contact. Rubbing? Does she rub around you more, perhaps?
Rubbing, and then if she really wants my attention, she initiates the slow blink.
Lovely. Love that.
I mean, we have been slow blinking with her since she was little, but if she really wants to just melt our heart, she'll slow blink first. Can you talk about what that is communicating?
So slow blinking is for people that don't know, it's hard to demonstrate on the radio, but it's where you slightly narrow your eyes, half close them and then open them again. And cats do this too. And so if you find yourself looking at a cat for maybe a little bit too long and you think, well, now what do we do? If you do this sort of squinty slow blink, they quite often do it back, and it's an indication that they feel comfortable, that they're comfortable with that situation, puts them at their ease. And like I say, they will often reciprocate it if you do it. And it's just a way of breaking the ice, if you like, sometimes between you and a cat. So, it's a lovely way of connecting with your cat. Try it at home.
We have less than a minute left. How could communication between cats and people, cats and their owners, potentially evolve in the future?
Well, that's a great question. And I think how I want it to evolve is that would love for people to just watch their cats more, take a closer look at their cats in their lives and think about what their cat is seeing and smelling and hearing and how best they can, you can interact with them, because I think there's so much more for us to explore with our cats that we're missing out on at the moment, that we have with our dogs that we don't do with our cats. So I think the world is our oyster in terms of what we can say to each other with our cats.
I love that. And, also I have constant communication with I'm always talking with the cat. Like, I'll be reading your book and then I'll tell our cat Maddie what I learned. Is that type of communication effective, do you think?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's how, cats will meow and we talk back to them in a similar, high-pitched voice quite often. And these dialogues develop between ourselves and our pets, and that's how our relationships, develop. It's brilliant.
Oh, Sarah, what a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun.
Sarah Brown, independent cat behavior scientist. New book is called The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.